All right, so I need your help tonight, all of you, because I have a lot I want to say, and I'm a little afraid that this is going to turn into like I blather on and on and look out at the sea of faces getting kind of sleepier and sleepier. So I encourage you, as I talk about this topic, that you I know monitor your own responses and see where, kind of confusion comes up, or maybe kind of aversion or attraction or desire or intrigue or something, and see if you can raise your hand and ask a question or share something or make a comment so that it's a more interactive thing. So tonight is the I can't remember what number class it is, but we're studying the 10 fields of Zen, and this is field 8. And I'm calling it Realization, Awakening to Your True Nature. So last week we talked about studying the self and briefly got into karma work. And karma work is very important. And I'm sorry to have given that a short shrift. But I suggested I might talk about it this week, but I'm not going to because I've got too much to cover. So not that it's not important. Actually, we could maybe do a little series on it or something. But I do talk a lot about it in the chapter of the book that we've been studying. So if you wanna study more about karma work, which is taking care of your life and working through your karma, check the website and read that chapter. So when I title this Realization, Awakening to Your True Nature, I'm very studiously avoiding a particular word, which could be substituted for that, but also tends to be quite problematic. So I'm just gonna like use it tonight and we can kind of wrestle with it, eject it, leave it behind, carry it with you, whatever you like. So that word is Kensho. Kensho is a term that is used much more often in Rinzai Zen than Soto Zen. So we're a particular, flavor of Zen. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that in a little bit. But it's recognized as a thing. I brought, for instance, tonight I brought this book, You Are Still Here, by one of my teachers, Kjøgen Carlsson, and in it he has a chapter called Kensho, and he describes his Kensho experience. So what I'm hoping you take away is like the importance of this. But also, there are 10 fields of Zen. This is one of the fields. Certain Zen teachers, certain Zen lineages would tell you that this is the most important of all of them. The other ones just like serve to point you toward this. And then there is like, putting it into practice in your life. That's also very important. But this seems like this is like the pivot point, right? Like you aim everything at this as at awakening to your true nature, and then manifest it in your life. We don't, in Soto Zen, we generally don't do that. We acknowledge that we want to awaken to our true nature. We acknowledge that sometimes people have awakening experiences, but in the I think it's a preface to Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Somebody asks, Suzuki Roshi, if he's had Satori, which is another word for this, and his wife was there, and she said, or he, what did he say? Oh, why don't we emphasize Satori? And his wife says, it's because he hasn't had it. And he says, it's not that it isn't important. Now I wish I had it. But anyway, he says basically, it's not what needs to be emphasized. So that's kind of the approach that we take in Soto Zen, is that this is happening. This moving toward awakening to our true nature is happening, but it's not like we're not like arrow focused on it and then neglect everything else, that we bring it all along, right? We practice in all 10 fields as well as this one, and just kind of trust that the whole thing is going to move us closer to this insight. But here's Bodhidharma. So this is the first Zen teacher in China. Buddhism had been in China before that, but so this is ages ago. So Bodhidharma says, he'd be one of the ones that, okay, so Dave just put the quote. I had the op 4 months before his death, I had the opportunity to ask Suzuki Roshi why Satori didn't figure in his book. His wife leaned toward me and whispered impishly, "It's because he hasn't had it." Whereupon the Roshi batted his fan at her in mock consternation and, with a finger to his lips, hissed, "Shh, don't tell him." When our laughter had subsided, he said simply, "It's not that Satori is unimportant, but it's not the part of Zen that needs to be stressed." So here's Bodhidharma stressing Satori. To find a Buddha, you have to see your nature. Whoever sees his nature is a Buddha. If you don't see your nature, invoking Buddhas, reciting sutras, making offerings, and keeping precepts are all useless. Invoking Buddhas results in good karma. Reciting sutras results in a good memory. Keeping precepts results in a good rebirth. And making offerings results in future blessings, but no Buddha. This is from, I think it's the Bloodstream Sermon. There's not too many Bodhidharma writings, so you'd be able to find it. To find a Buddha, all you have to do is see your nature. Your nature is the Buddha. And the Buddha is the person who's free, free of plans, free of cares. If you don't see your nature and run around all day looking somewhere else, you'll never find a Buddha. The truth is, there's nothing to find. But to reach such an understanding, you need a teacher, and you need to struggle to make yourself understand. Life and death are important. Don't suffer them in vain. There's no advantage in deceiving yourself. Even if you have mountains of jewels and as many servants as there are grains of sand along the Ganges, you see them when your eyes are open. But what about when your eyes are shut? You should realize then that everything you see is like a dream or illusion. So there's many, many Chan and Zen ancestors who were just like, oh, just awaken to your true nature. Just wake that this is all about awakening to your true nature. So just tonight we read one of our Soto Zen ancestors, Hongzhi. So this is one of my favorite lines. People have heard it a lot, where he warned, if illumination neglects serenity, then aggressiveness appears. But if serenity neglects illumination, murkiness leads to wasted dharma. So the radically non-dual practice of letting go, like shikantaza, is serenity. Right? It's not pursuing anything. While illumination is a conscious orientation toward the truth. So if illumination, if you're just striving for an enlightenment experience without, practicing serenity and letting go, then aggressiveness appears, right? Like competition and striving and frustration and judgment, all that kind of stuff. But if serenity neglects illumination, murkiness leads to wasted dharma. So, this is one of people have seen me turn to this before. Seems like I have to kind of read from it like once a year, once every other year or so. So this is the Three Pillars of Zen by Philip Kaplow, and this is a Rinzai, hardcore Rinzai koan lineage. So he's talking about Kensho. This is not it's actually Yasutani, one of his the teachers in his lineage. He is talking about Kensho. So the aims of practice and what the one of these aims is Kensho Godo, seeing into your true nature, and at the same time seeing into the ultimate nature of the universe and all the 10,000 things in it. It is the sudden realization that I have been complete and perfect from the very beginning. How wonderful. How miraculous. If it is true Kensho, its substance will always be the same for whoever experiences it. Whether that one be the Sh Buddha Shakyamuni, the Buddha Amida, or any one of you gathered in this temple. So, this, I often talk about like reality with a capital R, and we have these teachings on suchness and emptiness and the relative and absolute and all of that. But it's like the gateway, if you will, to like a real personal experience of those truths are about your nature. It's like that's where it all begins. We have to realize our own true nature, and then we look out and we see thus is everything, right? So this is the key. The pivotal realization is about our own true nature. And he talks about different degrees of this kind of opening and awakening, which is very helpful. He says, imagine a person blind from birth who gradually begins to recover his sight. At first, he can see very vaguely and darkly and only objects close to him. Then, as his sight improves, he's able to distinguish things a yard or so away and so on until he can see really clearly a long way. So these are kind of It's there's different, I don't know. Kensho covers a lot of things. Oftentimes we talk about it in terms of a very dramatic shift in awareness, but it's all like all the realizations are of a kind. And actually Kyogen talks about that in his book. He has a chapter called Sudden and Gradual, and how for some people it's a big abrupt thing. But even if it's a big abrupt thing, it's not just one big abrupt thing, right? Like there's more to see. It's nobody goes from completely blind to like now they can see for thousands of miles, right? So it's always has a kind of a gradual aspect to it. So another goal in practice acknowledged by the Rinzai folks as well is Mujo Do no Taigen, the actualization of the Supreme Way throughout our entire being and our daily activities. So this is like, practice and enlightenment are one and manifesting it. So this is what Yasutani says. The Rinzai sect tends to make Satori hyphen awakening the final aim of sitting, and skims over Jōrikki, so kind of establishing the the calm mind, the practice of serenity, skims over Jōrinki and Mujōdō no Taigen, the aspect of, making it real in your life. Thus, the need for continued practice after enlightenment is minimized. And koan studies, since it is unsupported by zazen and scarcely related to daily life, becomes essentially an intellectual game instead of a means by which to amplify and strengthen enlightenment. On the other hand, while the practice advocated in the official quarters of the Soto sect today stresses Mujōdō no Taigen, the, manifesting it in your everyday life, in effect, it amounts to little more than the accumulation of Jōrinki, the concentration of zazen, which, as I pointed out earlier, leaks or recedes and ultimately disappears unless zazen is carried on regularly. The contention of the Soto sect nowadays is that Kensho is unnecessary and that one need do no more than carry on daily activities with the mind of the Buddha. The contention that Kensho is unnecessary and that one need do no more than carry on daily activities with the mind of the Buddha is specious. Long. For without Kensho, you can never really know what this Buddha mind is. So, in Kyogen's story, so he talks about coming to the monastery as a young person, and he's mostly interested in just meditation. But he stays and he practices, and then he confesses that he was very intrigued by the koan story of Chiyono, who one moonlit night, so she practiced meditation for a really long time and didn't achieve awakening. At last, one moonlit night, she was carrying water in an old pail bound with bamboo. The bamboo broke and the bottom fell out of the pail, and at that moment, Chiyono was set free. In commemoration, she wrote a poem. In this way and that, I tried to save the old pail. Since the bamboo strip was weakening and about to break, until at last the bottom fell out. No more water in the pail, no more moon in the water. So he talks about a experience that he had as a young man, just kind of an opening experience of falling away, a sense of universality and tranquility, but he didn't have any context for it, and it just the memory of it just kind of faded away, but it did set him on kind of on a spiritual quest. So now he's at the monastery and just practicing and practicing as hard as he possibly can. And Roshi Kennett, his teacher, would say that in order for awakening to occur, a student has to hit bottom, get to the end of the rope. So at Shasta Abbey, where my teachers, Kyogen and Gyokuko, trained, even though it was a Soto monastery, and this is not uncommon, like I think Ellen in her Sangha Voices talked about a new book that's out about women training in Japan at this, it's a Soto Zen monastery, but they did koans and they talk a lot about awakening. So this is how Roshi Kennett trained. So she really pushed people, and so-and-so would have a Kensho, and then everybody would know so-and-so had a Kensho. And so anyway, Roshi Kennett used to say that in order for awakening to occur, a student has to hit bottom, get to the end of the rope. That would drive me nuts. I hated the idea. Here I was improving in my meditation. I was getting it together, learning about the precepts, learning about myself. I was cultivating the paramitas and saw my practice as a gradual upward path. How am I supposed to hit bottom when I'm going the wrong way? So I was annoyed by her saying that. And he didn't know what to do. So we kind of talked about relating to the sense of in Pure Land Buddhism where you just kind of pray for grace. So he started to just kind of say to himself, Please make me worthy of this grace. Because clearly, self-power really wasn't getting him there. So anyway, then he tells this story. And he also does the Zen thing of climbing to the top of a 100-foot pole, then take one more step. And he's like, how? I don't know what to do. So he talks about spending the day climbing Black Butte, because Shasta is down in Northern California, across the highway from the monastery. So they were climbing up to the top of this butte so they could get a picture of the monastery from above. And they climbed up the wrong side. And it was really hard. Like, that ended up being there was a trail on the other side. It's like scale, a big shale pile, really steep and towering volcanic rim. So they're exhausted. He's getting blisters and all this stuff. They got back really late, missing dinner. He was exhausted, had a pounding headache, and that was okay at the monastery to like sleep in through morning zazen if you had just, an awful day the day before. So he did that, and then he came into the monks' hall for breakfast. And once he got there, like Roshi Kenneth made some kind of offhand remark about some other monk who was like was at early morning zazen, even though he had a lot to do. And Kyoga's just like, oh, so she says about this other monk. There's a monk who really wants the practice. And I thought, oh shit. My veins are open and I'm giving everything I've got to this place and this practice, and I miss one lousy sitting period. And she praises this person who turns up this morning. Well, I'm not quite sure what happened next. I think I may have started to cry. I thought, what the hell is the point? Roshi asked me, well, what is it? I said, there's just no love here. I meant that I felt completely unseen. She got up and walked across the room and looked deep into my eyes and went, and walked away. And then breakfast arrived. The other monks hadn't made it down yet. It was just her and me and one other monk in the refectory. I was sitting there looking at my plate. She said, Kyogen, look up. And I thought, yeah, right. I've heard that one before. She said, no, I mean it. Look up. Kind of sat up, but was still looking down at my plate. To me, what she meant was, look on the bright side, be cheerful, be a good little monk, and do everything with a bright, shiny face. I thought, oh, but I sat up. She said, no, I meant it. Put your hands palm up and look up. She came around behind me and took my hands and turned them over. I looked up and boom, I was just flooded with a release and affirmation. I won't try to describe all the stuff that happened, but I ended up under the table, laughing my fool head off. So he doesn't describe like what happens and what he feels and all that, but in the Three Pillars of Zen, there's a whole section, and I always feel ambivalent, right? Because I don't really want to encourage people to read this book. There's a lot of stuff in here which is like very different from our lineage. It's very emphasizes very different things, and I don't know. I feel like you could go down some really unhelpful rabbit holes without like if these aren't your teachers, then you could go down some unhelpful rabbit holes. But that said, they collected some stories from people. I guess it was, I don't know if it was Yasutani, one of the teachers in this lineage asked people to write down their experiences, like their Kensho experiences. So there's an assortment of them in here, and they're all different kinds of people. And he explains, so Cap Lo explains why, just he included these stories because a lot of times, all right, there's some, Chan master from like 1,000 years ago, and they have some kind of experience, and you're just whatever, like we can imagine that it was just a different time, different kinds of people, different culture. It's hard to relate, to their opening experiences. So these are just like, there's like Mrs. DK, a Canadian housewife, age 35. Like, they're just, just people. And he said, what manner of people were these who, like the carp in the Chinese fable that leapt up the waterfall in a mighty thrust to become a dragon, could rise to a higher level of consciousness, to a wholly new awareness of the invisibility of all life and the basic emptiness of all things? Certainly none was gifted with extraordinary intellect, nor were any endowed with supernormal powers. Suffering they had each known, but it was no more than what's expected in the lifetime of an ordinary person. If they were exceptional in any way, it was simply in their courage to go they knew not where, by a road they knew not of, prompted by a faith in their real self. So they, I just worked really hard. So this is just the kind of the end of the story of let's see, Mr. PK, an American ex-businessman, age 46. So he spent 5 years in one of the Japanese monasteries over there. So he tried this really hard, like painful, like really painful sessions, and like cold and just physically demanding and everything. So he just kept at it. And I think it was this guy. He did Shikantaza for a long time, and then he just asked for the koan mu because he just couldn't quite break through. So he had been practicing Mu for quite a long time, but his session, the residential meditation retreat, and he just threw himself into Mu so that he says, I completely vanished. I didn't eat breakfast, Mu did. I didn't sweep and wash the floors after breakfast, Mu did. I didn't eat lunch, Mu ate. So this is a koan. Does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu replies, Mu, which is kind of no or nothing. But the koan isn't used in that way, like, what does that mean? Who has Buddha nature? Is Buddha nature depending on sentience or not? It's like that's not how koans are used. In particular, this one is used as a breakthrough koan where, like, forget about anything but Mu. You just chant Mu, you think Mu. Mu becomes like the symbol, the focus of all of your doubt just becomes Mu, and you just, whenever you think of it, just Mu. So I didn't eat lunch, Mu ate. Once or twice, ideas of Satori started to rear their heads, but Mu promptly chopped them off. Again and again. So there's, saying this is why, like, striving for this doesn't work, because if essentially what you're trying to realize is there is no you and there's no separation between you and all things, the harder you try to have a realization, the less that's possible, right? Okay, so it's like, what do you do then? So then Mu is a way to, like, as soon as you start to have a sense of yourself and like, oh, maybe I'm getting onto something here, you just moo, you just, chant moo. Again and again, the monitors whacked me. They have a stick that they whack you with if you're falling asleep, crying, victory is yours if you don't relinquish your hold on moo. So afternoon Dokusan goes in to talk to the Roshi. Hawk-like, the Roshi scrutinized me as I entered his room, walked toward him, prostrated myself, and sat before him with my mind alert and exhilarated. The universe is one, he began, each word tearing into my mind like a bullet. The moon of truth. All at once, the Roshi, the room, every single thing disappeared in a dazzling stream of illumination. I felt myself bathed in a delicious, unspeakable delight. For a fleeting eternity, I was alone. I alone was. Then the Roshi swam into view. Our eyes met and flowed into each other, and we burst out laughing. Just think about I Heart Huckabees. It was like one of the most beautiful portrayals of this in art. So if anybody familiar with that movie,
What is it?
I Heart Huckabees.
Heard of it.
Well, gosh, now you all have to go out and see I Heart Huckabees. It's a very funny movie. It has Dustin Hoffman and
Jason Schwartzman.
Jason Schwartzman. Anyway, Dustin Hoffman like is explains like people come to him. It's like they hire him as like a private detective, but in the meantime, he's trying to get them to wake up, and so he does this demonstration. It's the blanket, and like what's his wife, the actress?
It's Lily Tomlin, I think.
Lily Tomlin is his wife. So Lily Tomlin has a totally different approach, right? She's like dark and believes, nothing is connected and whatever. But he's all like, he brings out the blanket. She's like, oh, here he goes with the blanket again. It's like, here's me, here's you, but it's all the blanket. And then they do the special effects where like if somebody's looking to his eyes, and he's kind of getting them into it, then like it gets pixelated and little pieces of them like float around and float over and exchange like eyes with the other person. So anyway, you kind of want a little visual image of what this might be like. Check out I Heart Huckabees. So this character says, I have it. I know there is nothing, absolutely nothing. I am everything, and everything is nothing. I exclaimed more to myself than to the Roshi and got up and walked out. And he reminds him there's different, the Roshi reminds him, although your re realization is clear, you can expand and deepen it infinitely. There are degrees of Kensho. Take two people gazing at a cow, one standing in a distance, the other nearby. The distance one said, I know it's a cow, but I'm not sure of its color. The other says unequivocally, I know it's a brown cow. So this character returns to the main hall. As I slipped back into my place, Grandmother Yamaguchi, our part-time Goto, tiptoed over to me with eyes aglow, whispered, wonderful, isn't it? I'm so happy for you. I resumed my zazen, laughing, sobbing, and muttering to myself. It was before me all the time. Yet it took me 5 years to see it. A line Tongan San had once quoted me rang in my ears. Sometimes, even in the driest hole, one can find water. And so, a little bit later, he's reflecting, feeling free as a fish swimming in an ocean of cool, clear water after being stuck in a tank of glue, and so grateful. Grateful for everything that has happened to me. Grateful to everyone who encouraged and sustained me in spite of my immature personality and stubborn nature. But mostly, I am grateful for my human body, for the privilege as a human being to know this joy like no other. So, we practice this, like, everything that we do is in support of this. Nurturing our bodhicitta, sitting zazen, spending time with sangha, dealing with our karma, all of this. But in particular, as my chapter on realization, we are aiming to be able to experience quiet mind. And then silent mind. And you might, and then this makes it possible for us to experience samadhi, which is non-dual awareness. Now, As you all know, I really don't like directed effort practice. Like, we sit zazen in order to make our minds quiet, in order to achieve this. Again, this is just like striving for a satori or kensho, right? When it's like the harder you try, the more you kind of mess it up. So I like our approach of letting go, letting go, and letting go, and letting go. And in that space, like, the mind can become very clear. My experience of it, I have a very busy mind. Some people, have quieter minds. My experience of this is I have to go to session. I have to go to a residential retreat where we are, that's all we're doing. It's silent, dawn till dusk. We're just sitting. And 95% of my zazen, we should never call our zazen shitty. But it's not, it's boring, or it's sleepy, or it's painful, or it's that kind of like, something's not right. But over the days of sitting, because it's the sheer quantity of sitting, and we're all sitting together, and there's an energy that we bring to it, and then it'll just be, there'll be a zazen period, there'll be 5 minutes out of a zazen period or something where it's just the light on the floor in front of you, and you can. When that mind gets very quiet, a different kind of perception is possible. When our mind gets very, so I say quiet mind is when, like, things have settled down, right? And you still, thoughts appear, but they don't bug you, right? So that is a very wonderful and rewarding thing to experience. However long you manage to experience it. And then silent is where it's really like, and this may not experience this very long, but there's really just does nothing. It is just, but not a empty, I mean, it's a full nothing, right? There's no extra. It's just everything that is going on is full and luminous and rich, just your breath and the floor and the bed. All of it. So in that silence, then it's like, what most of us do when we're in that space, like, is then we go like, oh, I think this is it. And then like, so that's what he said, those little bits of like the thoughts of Satori come up, like, oh, and it's like, it seems to make sense, right? I got this far. So now, what should I do to like let go even more? And then it just goes away. So Kyogen talked about it as like you make a lap for the cat, the samadhi cat, that you can't make samadhi happen. You have to just make a mind very silent and still and just open and who knows what's going to happen, right? And then something fresh may be able to happen. Something that you have not conceived of before may be able to happen. And that is where our this these ra this radical shift of insight can occur. And this is what I mean, you still have to go back to your life and work on precepts and karma and change your habits and all of that. And actually, many of you might be aware of a book by his name is escaping me at the moment, Jack Kornfield, I think, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. Because it is a really, like, it's a serious thing and actual problematic, right? Like, if you have given yourself over to the practice like this, and you do have an experience or two or three or whatever, then it's just like, what do I do with this? And then you go back and it's like back, and your habits are still there, and a few weeks later you find yourself just like being petty, and now it feels even worse, right? Because now you kind of have some insight into it. So why doesn't that translate? So there's still lots of work to be done. But Kyogen, in his book, he quotes Roshi Kennett. He said, "Somebody who has seen a ghost can never be someone who has never seen a ghost." Right? This changes us, and we can have faith that it does change us. Not in maybe not in the way, as much as we would like, not in as permanent a way, but it changes it. And you can never really believe all this shit in quite the same way again, or take ourselves quite as seriously again. So, I'll leave it there for some questions and comments. And yes.
How do you keep climbing past the top of the 100-foot pole?
How do you keep how do you take that step off the 100-foot pole?
I would say that you're not the person that's at the top of the pole.
Maybe not. Yeah.
So I used to be quite reactive, and I can get angry really quickly. And I feel like, I've done a lot of work. Buddhism has been really, really important in my life. But recently, I'm a hospice doctor, and one of the nurses calls me and says something, and she was anxious. So I said to her, because she was asking me a question, and I really like the nurses to give me like they're going to do. And so I was joking with her. I said, "Did you want me to spoon feed you the information?" And I was kidding. I was just, it was just to open it up. It didn't go over very well. So the administrator calls me and she says, she's threatening to quit because of you. And I thought, oh my God, what have I been doing this whole time in Buddhism and fixing myself if I have just destroyed this poor woman's life to the point that she wants to quit because she never wants to work with me. So I've had these moments where it's like, what am I doing and how have I changed? I ended up calling her and really, really apologizing. She never called me back, but she didn't quit. So, but it's like sometimes I think, wow, I am still so clueless. Like all of this work, this mindfulness, and I had that moment where I could not read the room or the phone. I just couldn't. I couldn't read the situation. And I think, so I still have these moments, and I'm thinking, like, is the whole point is that we recognize and we just go forward, or are we never supposed to have moments like that anymore where we offend people unintentionally, obviously, but anyways, I don't know. So that really, I felt really bad. I felt horrible about the whole thing. So anyways.
Well, the I mean, that highlights the importance, right? So we have the two aspects of self, learning the self. We have karma work and seeing the true nature of self. So the karma work is like, I mean, I know people who have had dramatic Kensho experiences, and their lives are don't look any easier. They don't think, they would never regret having that experience, right? Like it's like transformative in a way, but their karma is still their karma. And so that, there's still that work to be done. So like like I said at the end of the last class, we're like, Kyogen's back door got changed, so it opened on the other side. And every morning, as he went to let the cat out, he and the cat went to the wrong side of the door. And then eventually, over the course of a couple of weeks, they started going to the right side of the door at the same time. So even though he had the insight, he knew the door had changed. His habit didn't change any faster than that cat.
You're still gonna piss off nurses for the rest of your life.
But I mean, there's but what perhaps, but also, like your ability to just, oh, oops, and adjust and apologize without like having to like beat yourself up, and that is a fruit of practice as well. And I do think that the more that we appreciate the true nature of self, and we feel less like we have to protect, the less we have to prove anything, the less, we just we're more grounded moment by moment, I think. And we get pulled off based on our karma, but then more quickly we can come back to being grounded. So there's that too. It's not, well, we might get pulled off, but like I know, I've confessed I've had problems with anger, not like deep anger at people and whatever, but like just getting irritable and like, wah. And it used to be that when that happened, then it was like, I don't know, it just ruined the whole day, right? And then I felt shitty about getting angry, and it was just like the waves just went on and on and on. And now, like, I get angry, do something, throw something because I got irritated, and I'll be like, well, there we go again, And then it's like, I can drop that immediately, right? There's no, like, the waves subside much quicker, so it makes a difference. Phil.
I saved that handout from last week, and I keep reading true self or your true nature, not a thing. Our true self nature is no self nature. And I find that very comforting because then I don't have to look for it. I can just focus on the practice, and whatever it is or isn't, then doesn't really matter. So. Thank you.
But insight into that matters.
Right, from through the practice, as opposed to analyzing and looking and, oh, look, that's my true nature. That's how I feel about it.
Well, and in a way, one of the very valid questions you could ask is, well, if you can't grasp it, if it's not really a thing, then how do you know you saw it? Like, how do you know you woke up to it? Like, how do you know it's it? And the best way that I can describe that is that you're not waking up. Well, you kind of are, but whatever. Like, you're not like, I found it. I found my true nature. What we see is we let go of all of the shit that we're laying over everything. And when we allow that to fall away, and then the true nature is just there, just reality is just there, we know that oh, I recognize this stuff, this is my stuff, and I can drop that. So it's like, yeah, it's not a thing that we are proposing exists, and when we give it qualities and try to prove it, right? It's more like, I know this is my stuff, and I was able to drop it, and there it was. Every time you think you come up with a good way to describe it, you realize it's inadequate, but there you go. Tyler.
Sorry, I couldn't find myself on the screen. This is more like a technical, like, who decides you've had like Kensho or like, if you're like, I did it, and they're, like, I think I had it. They're like, no, you're not. You're like, all right, I guess not. Like, I just like, I don't even like it seems like a weird thing to try to have to prove it, or I don't know. I'm just sort of curious.
I mean, it's a good question. And the Zen tradition, the Chan tradition, Soto and Rinzai has a very strong tradition of teachers, and that you don't do this without a teacher, and that's the interaction with the teacher is an important component of it. And yet, there is an aspect of it where it's like, I'm going to this person to like, and they're gonna decide whether I've got it, and like, oh, that seems kind of screwed up, and like, but I guess if we don't get caught up, and this is why we don't really talk about Kensho, if we don't get caught up in that concept, did it happen? Didn't, was that it? If we don't, and we don't worry about categorizing it, then it doesn't matter at all. Right? You know what you have experienced. You know what you have awakened to. You know what has the insights and the shifts in perspective which have lasted, and they have made a difference in your life, right? You don't need anybody to tell you that. So the value though of like interacting with a teacher is when sometimes we're like, yeah, I've got that. And then they challenge it, and they point us toward what could be deeper, right? Like that is, I mean, when I'm in Rahatsu, I'm gonna be going to see Hogen in Sanzen, right? And there's we get it's like we just can't help it. We get into these like, I think I got this one. I think I got this one. Or we think I don't have this one, right? Either one or the other trap we fall into, and we go in, and then, like, he's gonna show me something that I don't already see. Or he's gonna point me towards something I don't already see, which to me is just like, just incredible. I feel so much gratitude for that. And there is like, I don't know what, like dramatic openings. Generally, technically, you go to somebody who has had a dramatic opening, and they, you ex relate your experience, and then they kind of say yay or nay. I mean, Kyogen and Gyokuko did this as well with some of the people, Adharma Rain, who had experiences. And my teacher Gyokuko, like me, has never had a like, fall under the table laughing experience. But Gyokuko said when a couple of her students did, she actually found it very affirming that, they talked to Kyogen. Okay, he said, yeah, but that it, they had not woken up to anything that she had not woken up to. Even though she didn't have one of those dramatic experiences, it was just a different way for it to unfold. Well, I guess it brings us to nine or one and two. So, yeah. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Vajra Paramita. And a pitch then. for coming to our April session. Come to our April session in person if you possibly can, in the cloud if not.
Good night.
Thank you, Dilmio, and everyone.